welcome to the Fantasy Rewind Podcast. I'm your co-host, Dylan Stoll, and as always, I'm joined by my friend Mike.
Hey.
So today, we are going to go a little bit out of our wheelhouse and talk about the movie...
Big Fish.
Big Fish. And you want to give us some details on that, Mike, as far as...
Yeah, absolutely. So Big Fish was directed by Tim Burton. It's a 2003 movie, so, I mean, as wild as it sounds to us.
20-plus years ago.
21 years old. Yeah. Insane. It has an IMDb rating of 8 out of 10, a Rotten Tomatoes score of 75%, and a Metacritic score of 58%. And like I said, it was directed by Tim Burton, so you already know one actress who had to be in there, and that was Helena Bonham Carter.
Twice. She was in there two times.
Yeah, she is. and it's starring Ewan McGregor and Albert Finney, who's playing the same character, Edward Bloom. One, Albert Finney is playing the older version. Ewan McGregor is playing the younger version. You have kind of a wild, kind of a big cast outside of that. Mm-hmm. You have Billy Crudup, who's playing Edward Bloom's son, Will Bloom. Matthew McGrory, Carl the Giant. He's playing Carl the Giant, sorry. Jessica Lange, who's playing Sandra Bloom, the wife of Albert Finney.
Danny DeVito.
Danny DeVito in there. Daniel Wallace is in there at one point. Allison Lohman, Marion Cotillard, Steve Buscemi. Gosh, I'm terrible with a lot of these names. I'm just going to stop there. But there's a lot of different people in there. The actor who plays the Oompa Loompa is in there at one point, who is also in the Tim Burton's version.
Yeah, you know?
And that actor is Deep Roy, and he plays Mr. Soggy Bottom, which I just love that name.
So,
but yeah, lots of people.
Before we get into anything else about the movie here, I'm just going to give out the typical reminders. So if you want to get in contact with the show, an email is fantasyrewindpod@gmail.com. We're also on Instagram, which is @FantasyRewindPod, and X, which is @FantasyRewind. All right, Mike, without any farther delay, let's dive into the rewind. Fantasy Rewind.
All right, Big Fish, Dylan. Broad stroke on this film, it's a reconciliation tale between a dying father and his son. I mean, at the heart, that's what this story is.
At the heart, that's what the movie is. Yeah, for sure.
And it is, I think when we say it's out of our wheelhouse, this isn't what we would think about as traditional fantasy.
Right. This is not high fantasy at all.
No. I mean, because it's taking place in the real world. It's so hard to even, like, kind of start to, like, tackle this. I think it might be good for us to just sort of,
Well, so let me take this part here, Mike. So... where this crosses into fantasy is when you think about what makes a fantasy movie, what makes a movie fantasy, like what's the defining characteristics of a fantastical adventure, a fantastical movie. And to me, where Big Fish is a fantasy movie is it leans into the trope of like the American tall tale. Kind of like if you're talking about like John Henry, talking about like the big tall dude with the bull. I forget his name off the top of my head. But it leans into like those like American mythological figures and like adventures that are larger than life. And that's really where Big Fish lands in the fantasy genre, where it is a reconciliation tale between a father and a son. But it's done so through the lens of this father who always exaggerates and tells these tall tales about his life and how he's gone on these grand adventures and how his life, according to his son, isn't necessarily even something he even knows anymore because he's told these tall tales so many times that the son doesn't even know who his father really is. Mm-hmm. And so I just think that blending of like that, like old time American tall tale, trope is really where Big Fish dips into the fantasy realm of things.
Yeah. I would definitely agree with that. And the whole storyteller aspect of it, right? Mm-hmm. With the dad doing it, and like throughout the movie you get a couple other people also kind of telling the fantastical version of his life. And I think it's just pretty cool to just, I mean, watching it when I was younger, I was just like, wow, I didn't know we could have kind of movies like this, right? Where it was a blending of real life and fantasy. And like you said, in that tall tale kind of setting. And it really evokes sort of Odysseus's, like, the that journey, right, for Edward Bloom. And I think that was an inspiration for the novel this was based off of, which was Big Fish, a novel of mythic proportions. That's the name of it, by Daniel Wallace. Now, Dylan, you're talking about the tall tale. There's lots of different tall tales kind of within this in this movie. Was there one that stuck out to you as your favorite? I mean, outside of
the whole thing. I think that there are several stories within this that I think are really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my favorites has to do with the witch. So one of the tall tales, right at the beginning, right in the beginning of this movie here, one of the tall tales that is told is that where Edward Bloom lives, there's a witch who lives in the swamp, you know, like every town has. And so Edward Bloom goes to like see the house with a bunch of other kids, and they're all telling stories about, oh, you know, she has a glass eye that can see the future, and if you look directly at it, you'll see how you're going to die. And what's really interesting about this story to me is, like, all the kids, you know, are doing, like, kid stuff, like, ribbing on each other, saying, like, oh, you won't go and do this. And Edward Bloom's like, yes, I will. Watch me. So he goes, and he knocks on the door of the witch's house. Or, to take that back, he goes to the front porch, and the witch opens the door. And he introduces himself to the witch and just straight up says to her, I have some people that want to see your eye. And so he leads the witch back out to his friends, and he surprises them because they all thought that he was going to grab the eye itself. Instead, he brings the witch with him, and two of the friends that were there look at the witch's eye, see how they're going to die, and seeing all of this chaos that ensues after they see this, Edward Bloom walks the witch back to the house and says, you know, ma'am, I think I would like to see how I'm going to die, because if I know how I'm going to die, I know I'm going to survive everything else. And so he looks at the witch's eye, stays cool as a cucumber the whole time, and says, huh, so that's how it happens, and then walks away. And what I really like about this story, first of all, it sets it up really early in the movie that Edward Bloom, at least in this tall tale version, is a fearless person who is willing to do things others won't, and who wants to be this big fish in a big pond and outgrows like the small town life that he's in. But what I also really like about it is that it sets up kind of like that, like what is the way he's going to die type of situation.
Yes.
Because you're also introduced very early on in the movie to a dying old Edward Bloom who's dying from cancer or something, in a bed. And he's like, this isn't how it's going to happen. But you're waiting to see, like, what is, like, the truth? What is, like, the real way he's going to die? Or at least that he is going to tell people that how he's going to die. And so that kind of lingering, hanging question that you have all movie makes it one of my favorite stories from the movie.
Yeah, and what I think is really, I love that you brought that story up, because one, I love that it's threaded throughout all the other stories in so many different ways. There's so many nods to all the previous stories, and the fish, the catfish story, which he tells at the beginning, about how he caught the catfish, and it was a lady catfish, and you know, he connects it to marrying
William's only way mom. To catch an uncatchable woman is to give her a wedding ring.
Yeah. And that also is kind of threaded throughout, and I'm not completely sure, like, after watching the movie multiple times, I'm not completely sure still what the catfish, the female catfish, was was it just the metaphor for the mom? Like, was it more than that? Like, the wife? I'm not quite sure on that myself, but I do love that this story really does thread all these stories together and does it in such a very cohesive way that still leaves you to just kind of be like, is there more there? Even after watching it a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
And I do want to go through a few of the different tall tales.
Yeah.
And we don't need to go through all of them. I don't want to retell the whole movie because it is really worth the watch. And I think that's something that...
It's a good movie.
Yeah. This is one of my favorite movies. and mostly, I think when I was younger, the storyline between the father and the son not understanding the father, right? I think so many people can kind of relate to that, depending on, you know, your family dynamics and whatnot. But for me, that really resonated. And like that really hooked me in. And it's still a storyline that I think is just very interesting and kind of timeless in a lot of ways.
Definitely.
Now, I do have to talk about, so, you know, he has the whole death scene and there's his whole childhood growing up, yada, yada, yada. And he outgrows the small town. But as he's leaving the town with the giant.
With Carl the giant, yep.
He takes a shortcut and he ends up in the town of Spectre. And I was even talking to Alexis. I was like, what do you think Spectre is a metaphor for?
Yeah, so like for me, I think that the town of Spectre is almost like a... I almost want to consider it like the afterlife in a way, because like he gets to this town of Spectre and they're like, oh, Edward Bloom from this town. We weren't expecting you yet. And there's so many things that happen in this town. Like it's this perfect idyllic village that like just is everything you want it to be. It's entrapped this poet who was going to make his way to Paris, and he's there, who was really bad, actually. but he got sucked in by the charm of Spectre and never wanted to leave. And then, like, you have these people who basically just have a party every night, have the most amazing food, see all these people that they love and everything. And so to me, it really was a metaphor for the afterlife.
Yeah, so I agreed, and that's what I was thinking initially, or that's what I was thinking too, but as you were talking about it, it also just made me think maybe it was like a metaphor for the afterlife, but also for like that idyllic small-town life, like the perfect small-town life. You never want to leave your town, right?
Right.
It's that temptation to stay. You've outgrown your small town, but this is like the perfect small town.
Right, this is a different small town, but... Like, I almost also view it as, like, a metaphor for finding your perfect home, where, as a young man, you know, Edward Bloom had all these grand adventures he wanted to go on. He wasn't ready to settle down yet. He wasn't ready to get married.
Yeah.
He wasn't ready for all this stuff. And after he progressed through his life, he got to those points where he was like, you know, I want that house with the white picket fence. I want to have kids, all these other things. And so it's also kind of like that... Like, that growing up as a town almost is also what it's representing.
Yeah. And so I think there's a lot of different things with Spectre. And that's why I think it's a really interesting – it's always been an interesting part of this story because it comes back later, obviously.
Yeah.
It comes back
that's
too
the part
late.
That really gets me, though, is that the second appearance of Spectre.
Where it's changed from this idyllic small town where it's just a bunch of houses going down the center – to a bunch of businesses that are all foreclosed because a road came through, right? And so, you know, it could even be a metaphor for
small town America.
Yeah, small town America, right? Yeah, that's, I mean, you could do so much with it, but he goes back and he ends up buying up the entire town with the friends he's made along the way. And I always think that's just such an interesting part of the story. One that I felt like it was almost like a rest stop a little bit in terms of like action wise, like, but like a really interesting rest stop.
Yeah. The one thing that almost happened in Spectre that was, I'm glad it didn't, was basically him meeting the girl he was going to marry except she was 8 and he was 18. And, yeah. and so I'm glad that didn't actually happen. I was nervous going back and watching it again.
Well, and I'm glad too, like, that girl comes back again and, like, she's like, yeah, you know, I met a guy. I was 18. He was 28. And we ended up getting divorced because it didn't. That's a big age difference. And I was like, thank you for acknowledging that. Because sometimes it gets a little weird with some of these age differences with characters. But yeah. Another storyline I do want to talk about is, so we have the giant. It's the relationship between the mother and Ewan McGregor's character, right? And him courting her. And I think it's so fun that, like, the way it's told, he had to work at a circus for months, and every month he got a little bit of information.
He worked at the circus for 3 years.
3 years.
To learn this girl's name.
Uh-huh, yeah. It's so ridiculous, but at the same time, it's like, the actual story of how they would have met, and I put that in air quotes because obviously it's a fictional tale either way, but the actual story of how they would have met would never have been close to this tale. And that's kind of the purpose of a lot of these, right? As we find later on in the movie. But the whole circus scene is great. He's just doing all these crazy things. And it's like, yeah, he doesn't have to worry about putting his mouth in his line. He knows how he dies. That's how he can go through all these things and be fine with it.
Getting shot out of a cannon, like having all these like people on motorcycles race around him as he stands still, you know, like blades going in the car and the backstop around him, all kinds of stuff. Yeah.
And then come to find out that Danny DeVito's a werewolf.
Right.
I loved it. It's just so,
it was fun.
It's just, yeah, it's great. Yeah. What's another one of your favorites out of it?
So one of my other favorites is actually how he met up with the poet later on. The poet that he met, Inspector, who was Steve Buscemi, he ends up getting inspired by Edward Bloom leaving the town. He's like, you know what? I'm going to go and do that too. So he goes and sees the world, and he's like, come to find out, being a poet sucks. I'm not going to do that. I'm here to rob this bank that you're depositing your check in. Here, by the way, friend, you're helping me. And so he helps Steve Buscemi rob this bank kind of unwittingly. But why I like this is because it is like such this, just like such like a weird situation where he gets suckered into like helping with a bank robbery. And because of that, ends up like giving Steve Buscemi like a life lesson about why he should go into Wall Street. And then when Steve Buscemi does it and gets rich, he starts sending money back to Edward Bloom as well as like a payment for it. And that's one of the reasons why he was able to buy his perfect house, as well as buy up plots of land in Spectre as well, just through his rich friend's help that he made rich through career advice and a bank robbery.
Yeah, it's wild. And it is very cool, that nod, right? And I think too, that is an important thing with this story, is like these characters you meet through along the way, the giant, the conjoined twins,
yes,
Steve Buscemi's character, the Wall Street man, everyone from the circus, all the townsfolk of Spectre, they're in the story in so many different parts, whether he's like in their actual location or when he's going to buy the town of Spectre, he convinces all the people who aren't in Spectre to help him buy the land and save this town. And then at the end of the movie, when, you know, he has passed away, and we'll talk about the real big story there at the end in just a moment, but you have all of them kind of showing up.
And I love this part of the movie because it makes you question, like, wait, how much of this was a tall tale? How much of this, like, actually happened?
Yeah. You find out that a lot of the events were true. That's kind of where I was left with it, is the events were true-ish. But some of the details were fabricated. The conjoined twins were actually just twins.
Right. They were just sisters and not conjoined.
Yeah. But he was a circus director was there.
Yeah, was at a circus.
We can assume he was. We don't really know necessarily the townsfolk of Spectre were there. What I think is wild is that Carl he passed away before, like, the...
Before Danny DeVito? Yeah.
Or even the older people at Spectre, right? Like, I was like, the dad of the girl? Like, she's still around? Like, what? I thought that part was kind of like,
I think that was more so just to have more characters there for the callback of, like, hey, here's the big reveal. Some of this was true.
Yeah. And I love, too, that they kept one of the kids that went to the house with him. They kept him around as the doctor, right? And so he had regular interactions with the family. And he actually told the son, oh, do you want to know the actual story of your birth? And he told him it was like a perfect delivery, no complications. You were born, your dad was out of town on business. That's it. Whereas, like, the tale his dad tells is about catching the giant catfish with his ring and all this. And so, like, the son's kind of like, huh, well, I like the real version better. But at the same time, you kind of see, like, oh, yeah, I, like, as an audience member, you're like, I would rather have this fantastical tale told than.
Right. And the doctor even says that to him. He's like, don't you prefer the a little myth in your story or something like that? I forget the exact wording, but
yeah, it just makes it more memorable, right? I don't remember exactly what he said either, but yeah. But let's get to the kind of the point of the story, right? The son throughout this is trying to figure out what's real, what's not. Who his dad is. He had thoughts that maybe his dad didn't love him or his mother because he was on the road all the time, and he'd come back telling all these tall tales and like, what's real, what's not real? Did his dad have a second family? Like, I wouldn't be able to know. And that makes sense. Like, you don't really have you feel like you can't have a relationship with this person because everything out of their mouth is a lie, quote unquote, or, you know, a tall tale. And by the end of the movie, I think he sort of realizes the importance of that, right? Mm-hmm. And who his dad was. His dad was a big fish. And part of that, though, was telling these stories and just being a storyteller. His dad was a storyteller. Like, he was.
And what I also really enjoyed is at the end when his dad does pass away, part of what happens right before his dad dies is he makes his son tell him the story of his actual death. Like, tell him the story of the death he saw in the witch's eye. And he's like, Dad, I don't know that one. And he's like, just tell me what you got, basically.
Make up
and
a story.
So he kind of makes him a storyteller as well.
Yeah.
And you see that even at the very, very end, yes, where the son's son, because his wife's pregnant throughout the movie, is telling a story about Carl the Giant. And he's like, yeah, it was like 50 feet tall. And his friends are like, no. And he's like, right, Dad? And he's like, yeah, pretty much it. Just like kind of keeping that tradition going.
Yeah. And I think he would probably learn a little bit to maybe be like, no, actually, this is what happened. But like, which would you rather hear, you know?
Yeah.
Because I think watching the movie, even if you had a dad like that who told those fantasy stories all the time, you still do need that reality, right? You need to be able to differentiate between the two. And I think that was really the cool thing between the dad and the son, is the dad was like in this fantastical world pretty much all the time,
yeah,
whereas the son was very much in reality. And I think finding that balance between the two,
definitely. And I think that's really the point of the story, other than the reconciliation between father and son.
Yeah,
it's that you can't live 100% with 2 feet on the ground, head on your shoulders, not in the clouds, but you also can't live completely in your own fantasy world. You need to have that balance of the two.
Yeah. But the story he tells for his dad, I got to tell you, Dylan, like, I think every time I watch this movie at the end, I cry.
Like, oh, yeah. It's a super sad, super emotional scene.
I don't even know if it's like, it's not like I'm crying from just sadness. It's just like, it's so wonderful to see like the change in the character.
It's just a tender moment, yeah.
And the relationship rebuilt, and mm-hmm. the reconciliation and all of it. And it's just, it's honestly a little overwhelming, just like the happiness and the joy, like as his son's talking through this, how he releases his dad back into the water, right? And yeah, it's just such a powerful scene. I was crying.
yeah, same.
So good though. I can't recommend this movie enough. I know it's old now, but it holds up really well.
It really does. It's a fantastic movie with some fantastical elements, but not like your traditional like dragons, knights, wizards. Yeah. There's a witch, there's a giant, there's a werewolf, there's essentially a naiad. There's just the storytelling that goes along with like this like big fish in a small pond story. And again, like it's called Big Fish because like if you talk about, well, the dad being a big fish in a small pond, but also if you talk to any fisherman, anytime they tell you about the fish they caught, it's going to get bigger and bigger and bigger every time they retell the story. So it just has that classic like American style like legend kind of that goes along with it. Like a John Henry, like a Paul Bunyan, yes. All Johnny kinds of Appleseed, stuff like that.
All of it.
Johnny Appleseed, yeah.
Now, fun little fact, Dylan, and this is according to Wikipedia, so take it for what you will, but the set for the town of Spectre still remains and can be found in Wetumpka, Alabama at Jackson Lake Island, apparently.
Hmm. Interesting.
So,
fun little I have no thing. Intention of going there, but that's
somewhat interesting. If I'm ever in Alabama, I might...
If we'll I'm see. In Alabama at some point, maybe. Yeah. But one of the reasons we ended up covering Big Fish is I was looking at IMDb's top 100 fantasy movies.
Uh-huh.
And Big Fish is rated as number 61 as the 61st best fantasy movie based on the rating system that they have going on there. And so it's just very interesting to me because again, like despite some fantastical elements of this movie, I never would have like just put this in the fantasy category itself. I would have almost put it in a like comedic drama segment as opposed to a fantasy.
Yeah, I probably would have done drama. But yes, I agree. It is listed as fantasy on pretty much everything.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's... number one in my heart. Well, I shouldn't say that. It's definitely in my top 10 favorite movies, though.
Yeah. It really is a great movie.
It's
just
up there.
No number attached to it. Just, again, comes recommended by both Mike and myself. So if you have any desire to watch just like a straight up good movie, Big Fish is definitely going to be that for you.
I'd agree.
All right. But that's going to do it for us for our discussion of Big Fish. And again, we just highly encourage you to check it out if you have a chance to.
Absolutely.
But this is going to do it for Two Nerds, and we are signing off. Until next time, goodbye.
Bye.